This is Crosshairs Radio, episode 22. And on today's show, we are talking about the World Championships. This is Scott Dienbach, David Pallon for another installment of They Don't Do That in Europe. About a 90-minute discussion where we go from the juniors through the men's elite, all five races, all just unbelievable races. We were glued to the edges of our seats for all of them and get into a lively discussion about the results, about the drama, about the screw-ups, and yes, about the controversy, all in the show. What you can do to help us out here at Crosshairs Radio is get in touch with us. Let us know how we're doing. Feedback at cxhairs.com. Also follow along on Twitter and everything else at cxhairs. Go to the shop. If you go to cxhairs.com, top right-hand corner, not only is there one click that you can leave us your feedback on the contact page, but another click that you can go to the store, go look around, buy something, or don't. Also, the ads on the cxhairs.com. If you want to go check out the vendors that we have advertising on the site, that helps as well. All of it good. Episode 22. Let's get to it right now. I hand the controls over to Scott Dienbach, so he's going to take over. They don't do that in Europe. See you at the end.
All right, we are back on Crosshairs Radio for another edition of They Don't Do That in Europe. How are you guys doing today? On my right is Mr. David Pallon. David.
Back to the right side.
He got the call in first, Bill. I'm sorry. And on the left is in the crosshairs himself, Bill Shiken. Bill.
I don't mind being on the left. It's okay. It feels like old times that way.
There you go.
So, guys, we just had World Championships, and holy crap. Greatest World Championships ever? Question mark?
I think that if you, the juniors, men's juniors race was a fun race to watch, especially fun because it was the first time we were seeing the course. But I think that that was the only race out of the five where the race was decided after a couple laps.
Yeah, yeah. I'd say that was like an average, entertaining, good cyclocross race. And the other four races were mind-blowing.
Yes.
The three of us kind of were going into it, I think, with this sense of, yeah, well, hopefully the women's race will be kind of a race, but, you know, the men's is going to be one guy off the front, maybe two.
Right.
From the get-go. And yeah, we were so wrong on that, and it was so exciting.
And even the men's U23, I think that was the only one we were thinking, well, one of the J names is going to just run away with it. And,
right.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah, this is just awesome. So, well, let's get started. Let's start with the that juniors race that we're just going to go through the race for people listening. We're just going to go through the races in the order that they happened, talk about the stuff that we saw and how epic this world championship was. Starting with the juniors race, for us East Coasters, all of us are East Coasters, that prompted a 3:30 a.m. wake up for me to watch this race. That was early for us.
3:30? What were you doing for that first hour? It's a lot of coffee.
Well, see, I had to go. I went and watched it at my shop.
Oh, okay.
So I had to drive there. And so, yeah, I mean, I wanted to be there at 5 and make sure everything was working because I can't miss, you know, can't miss any of that.
But can't miss the review of tire choice.
That's right. All right, but let's just give the start out with the top five. In first place was Jens Dekker from the Netherlands. Second place was Michael Crispin. Third place, Thomas Bonnet. Fourth place, Kevin Kuhn. Fifth place, Thomas Pidcock. One thing noticeable out of that top five there, Bill, is not one Belgian name.
Yes. That was, I think there were two, yeah, no Belgians and no disc brakes. I think those were the two takeaways from that race.
Right. I mean, the top Belgian was seventh. Yeah, and so and no disc brakes. Now, are you attaching some significance to that?
No, I don't think so. People get all excited about it. Just sort of fanning those flames. I personally don't care, but that was the first thing I heard about. Did you see all the you know, because that's always the argument that I give. It's like, well, in 5 years, everybody's gonna be on disc brakes anyway, so we won't be arguing about it. And you can look at least in the past, the women's fields and the junior fields, and they're all on disc brakes, but God, I don't even know why I'm discussing this.
It's kind of like junior gearing, I think, right? They can only push such a gear, and they're not allowed to use disc brakes because they're dangerous.
And who knows whose bikes they were, you know, as we'll get to, one of the great stories coming up is a used bike. So maybe these are hand-me-down bikes that they're on.
I was just
going
to say that. These could be, you know, previously elite bikes that are just that are being handed down for them to use.
Unenhanced stuff.
Unenhanced.
Yeah. And it's we've seen in the past where junior fields do have a more international feel to them. And I think that is because once these riders get to a certain age, if they are in Belgium, there's a better chance that they have an opportunity to be professional cyclocross racers, where in other countries that's not going to be as much the case. So that's why your U23s and elites then get taken over more with more Belgians.
Yeah. But I mean, as far as, you know, this is one of the most internationally mixed top tens I think we've seen in a long time in the junior race.
How
I
about
mean,
the there, it was French? Like,
Yeah. These
all
guys
over
just
this race
rode awesomely. Yeah. So, I mean, that was kind of cool to see that. And that's what Worlds is about, I think. And to see that mix of all different countries in there was really cool. Was really, really cool. So let's talk about the Americans really quick. Gage Hecht got 12th. Eric Bruner got 17th. Spencer Petrov, 25th. Cameron Beard was 23rd. Spencer was 25th. Denzel Stevenson was 30th and Michael Owens was 46th. So
what did you hear back from Spencer?
So in case people don't know, Spencer right before Hoogerheide, was it Hoogerheide? What was the last World Cup?
Yeah, Hoogerheide.
Yeah, right. He had an accident. He crashed.
Oh, that's right. I remember. Yeah,
he had to go to the hospital, get x-rays. So was still not on his top of his game for sure. Even it was basically a full week later, but he said he was feeling it. You know, when he was really putting in efforts, he was feeling it in his. It's kind of like his backslash, the back of his ribs. You know, so he was feeling it on big efforts. He was saying so, not making any excuses, just you know, saying telling the reality. So that's kind of what was going on with him a little bit, I think.
Weren't there also some early crashes in this that basically that top 10 got away? And then because I think that's what happened to Gage, is he didn't have the best start that he wanted.
I think both Spencer and Gage, they didn't have great starts coming off the line there, and that put them both back. And I agree with what you said. You know, there was stuff that just kind of kept pushing them back farther and farther. Great efforts by these guys, all of them top to bottom, and it's just been awesome. I think they're great representation for the United States, and they all rode their hearts out, so props to them.
And they, along with the next race that we'll talk about, that U23 women, I think those two races had the worst conditions of the weekend.
Oh, by far, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that was like the wind. When I first turned that, the picture first came on, I started watching. I was like, and these flags are just sticking out, you know, parallel to the ground. I was like, holy crap, man. And everybody that was there was tweeting about the wind in those early races. And then the course, are you thinking course muddiness too, Bill?
Yeah, it just changed throughout the week. But in the first race and definitely in the second race, I mean, there were just huge puddles of standing water that we didn't see on Sunday.
Yeah, and sideways rain, and yeah, really challenging stuff there. So,
it's such a well draining or fast draining course. So it's a different kind of muddy situation, right? You have these deep puddles in places, some mud, but mostly deep sandy, dirt covered ruts.
Right,
come into play by the bouncer barriers a couple of times for in the women's racing and in the men's racing as well.
Yeah, it's the mud. It's, I guess, more of a sandy consistency, so your issue isn't going to be getting bogged down in the mud, but just it becomes so slick and treacherous, especially what you were saying, David, on those descents.
Yep. That transition from the downhill at the bouncy barriers, hard left, going from sand over that rut at the bottom into the slippery pavement, or as the Brits say, slippy pavement, it really took its toll.
Oh, in the the U23 men's race? That was the difference at the front of the race.
Yeah.
All right. let's move on to the women's U23 race. Now, Evie Richards, I mean, who is Evie Richards? Everybody was like, what is going on? And this girl just was amazing. Top five in the women's U23 race. First place was Evie Richards from Great Britain. Second place was Nikola Noskova from Czech. Third place was Maud. I can't mangle her name. I can't even pronounce it.
Oh, no, you can mangle it.
Cap, you can mangle it pretty well.
Cap Thiege. In fourth place was Sina Fria, Swiss rider. And then in fifth place, Nadja Hai from Austria.
Or Nadja Heigl.
Yep. We'll go with that, Nadja Heigl.
Okay. One cool thing about these top five, three 19-year-olds.
Yes.
Man, that's pretty amazing, including first and second place. And Evie Richards, the drama that, you know, this, you know, she's, I think she said she hasn't raced a cross race outside of England this year.
Ever.
Ever?
This was, so, you know,
it comes to
people, of course, I wanted to make this huge point about it, and I got corrected all the time. Well, she did win a silver medal in the mountain bike in the world championships. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not like she's this, I've never raced ever outside of the U.S., but this was her first, out of the U.S., out of Great Britain. This was her first ever cyclocross race abroad.
Yes.
Yep.
And she won the world championship.
Which is pretty good.
That's a good. Now, that's a good place to start.
Now, for people that were watching or weren't watching, the whole time she's riding, we're seeing this very familiar-looking Stars and Stripes, red, white, and blue Trek.
Which matched the British cycling kit wonderfully.
Yes, the colors are the same. It's just the stars were kind of interesting. And, I mean, very early on, I was like, as soon as I saw it, I said to I was sitting watching with some people, and I'm like, that's Katie Compton's bike. And then all of a sudden on Twitter, it started coming, is that Katie Compton's bike? And the announcers were like, people are wondering if that's Katie Compton's bike.
Yeah, it was actually Josh, I'm blanking on his last name, works for a Trek, who tweeted it out that was, in fact,
Katie's bike. Not now, it wasn't her. I think Simon Burney on the feed thought people were saying it was her current bike.
Oh, no, it was
a hand-me-down. One of her older bikes.
And, you know, everybody after the race wanted to make the same joke but didn't want to offend Katie Compton. And why we love Katie is she was the first person to publicly make the joke of saying, well, finally one of my bikes has won a world championship. Of course,
how
different
awesome
rider.
Is that? That was so great. Yes. She tweeted out, well, finally one of my bikes wins a world championship. Oh, that was just great. But the race as a whole was pretty good. I mean, there was some back and forth, but she did kind of, Evie Richards did kind of take control of it. It's about, what, three quarters of the way through, would you say? And then it was, you could tell, that was going to really be tough for any of those other girls to catch her.
And mountain biking skills. You know, it cannot be stressed enough on this course, especially in those conditions. She was able to handle the descents, which is the trickiest part of that course, and she was also smooth on the run-ups. Those are the two keys to it, you know.
Yep. Yeah,
that and the long climb, which for most riders out there at one point or another becomes a run-up. There were a few of the elite men, a few of the U23 men who rode the whole thing, but it was pretty rare for anybody to do that every lap of the race.
Yeah, some people could ride it to varying distances, but pretty much everybody, except for a few times, like you said, Bill, was having to dismount at some point and run up that. So running.
Yeah, and even as foreshadowing for the men's race, when we talk about that later, that basically was the key to the win.
Yeah. But to her credit, Evie Richards is not used to getting off her bike on steep climbs and transitioning from bike to run. So, and all the kudos to her for being able to bring those skills together and jumping off and running hard.
Yeah, and remembering back now to the race, what she did, and she actually won the race on the run-up. That the run-up, the sandy run-up, is where she took the lead, and she did it. She was the only one in that group that went to the left side. Everybody
right.
else took this line on the right to run. She was on the left, you know, time after time, and she was the only one doing it. And the last time, she was able to past the group and get out front, and then it was all over.
And she was on the left, if I remember, grabbing the side barrier.
She was.
To help
absolutely.
Herself out and balancing and just really hitting it hard.
Pro move.
And just, yep. You know, to illustrate, and this is something we talk about all the time, Bill, to illustrate how awesome this course was. Running was incredibly important throughout the entire weekend, over this all different parts of this course, and not one set of barriers was needed.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
I just said it. Absolutely. I got in trouble for saying absolutely a lot. I was trying not to
everybody
say it at
take
all.
A drink.
That was my first one.
Tim Johnson, everybody take a drink.
So I'm just looking back on the notes here from that race, and we're talking all of us, I mean, we've seen so many races. When she got that lead was, and you sort of referenced this before, Scott, that it was early, that was on the first lap. So after the first lap, she already had an 18-second lead going into the right. second lap.
That's true. Yeah, but I mean, I was saying, I think
only four laps in the race.
Right, right. It was a four-lap race, and but it wasn't at that point though. You still thought maybe she, you know, people still had time to run her down. But then, you know, as it went on, by lap two or even maybe three, it was nobody's catching her. She's gone.
Right.
So. Let's talk about the Americans really quick. Ellen Noble, sixth place. Hannah Arensman, 27th. Allison Arensman, her sister, 29th. Emma Schwartz, 32nd. And Laurel Rathburn, 35th. Ellen Noble putting in huge effort, especially at the beginning of that race. What'd you guys think about her?
I think that she felt that she should be at the front of that race, and she did everything she could to do that. I think that there were factors. Travel, whatever, that they kind of interfered with that, but I think she did a great job being there.
Yeah, it got pretty spread out near the end of that race. So you had, you know, second place came in 35 seconds after Evie Richards, and then 47 seconds, 53 minute 30, and then Ellen Noble was a minute 42 down. So it definitely started to spread out as the race went on, but I think she was excited with that result. It's top 10 result. You know, again, this is the first time that these women had the opportunity to race against their age group. Usually they're in the elite fields somewhere battling it out with the other pro women, so they're not able to race their own races. So this was a unique opportunity for all of these women who are at this high level to get to actually race against it. So the race dynamics and the strategy really was something that they were figuring out on the fly.
Yeah.
I think it changes the whole race because you're not, I don't want to say hiding behind or drafting, because drafting is somewhat, but not as much of a play. But like you said, Bill, there was a big spread in the front three or four places. But then where Ellen came in, it was 142 to Ellen, 147 to Alice, Maria Arzufi from Italy, and 150 to Juliette Lebois from France. So that was a group, and I think you just can put out more when you're riding with people and struggling with people, as opposed to just struggling off on your own, dangling in between other places.
And Scott, you forgot one American rider.
Who did
I
forget?
And I was going to bring that up as well. In 19th place, Sofia Gomez Villafane.
Oh, I'm sorry.
From America via Argentina.
Well, that's because she's marked as Argentina.
Oh, right. True.
Since we had that unfortunate. So this is the woman that came in second place, silver medal at U.S. Nationals. Did not know that there was extra paperwork that needed to be filled out because she had raced previously for Argentina to move her over for the UCI for the World Championship to a U.S. racer, since she is a U.S. citizen, lives in Boulder, Colorado. So that paperwork wasn't done. I'm not even sure. Didn't she say it wouldn't even be done by next year, but at like 2018 she'll be riding
as a
U.S. rider? I'm not positive. It may be next year, but it's something crazy like that.
Yeah, that's too
but
bad.
Still able to race in the U.S. as a, you know, race in the national championship and all that. It's just some quirky documentation that wasn't to what the UCI wanted for the World Championship.
Gotcha.
And props to Argentina for stepping up, because I don't think they had anyone else in this race.
Well, I'm sure they're more than happy to have a top 20 finish in the cyclocross
means.
World
now,
Championship.
Her?
I don't
know.
I
provided her pit support.
I we'll have to see. I will bet you she was still hanging out with the U.S. Compound, but not sure.
So, okay, yeah, well, that's cool. And, you know, another thing I want to say, this being the first time that we have this category, you know, history-making race, it was really good that it was a good race. You know, it was a good, solid race. There was drama. There was, you know, the stuff with Evie Richards, first time, you know. It's good that it wasn't a complete dud or something, because then I think, you know, it would have been, oh, this whole, we would have been hearing all this stuff about, I don't know, is this really a legit category, blah, blah, blah. This race firmly plants the U23 women's racing group as, yes, this is legit, guys. Check, this is awesome.
So, it was an amazing race to watch, but I'm, you know, I have to tell you, in my basement right now, nobody else down here except that it's getting a little crowded because there's this huge elephant sitting here.
We're getting to that. So, yeah, we all watch this race, and then we all watch the elite women's race. And then what was it? About a few hours, not even a few hours, maybe an hour or so after, we start hearing word about mechanical doping, or as the UCI likes to call it, technical fraud.
Yes.
Phil, do you want to fill us in? And if you want to get into the bird theft, you can.
So I'm sure that everybody who is listening to this, we don't even have to spend that much time on it, because everybody knows about this.
This is why cyclocross
is coming to the world stage in the last day or so, because there was a motor found in one of Femke's bikes, Van Drieschen's bikes. We don't know if she rode that bike in the race. There's implications from other riders and others out there that she rode this bike in other races. There's pictures from national teammates to trade team teammates saying, look at this bike. There's all this stuff out there. All we know is that 100% there was a bike with a motor in it, in the pits, that was assigned to her. That's what we know.
Right.
That's it. The family has said this. You know, they're saying that it wasn't her bike, that it was a friend's bike. The friend was riding with the brother and laid, you know, and it was a bike that Femke had sold to this guy the year before, so it looked like one of her bikes. He had leaned it against the RV. The mechanics came to get Femke's bikes. They took that bike unknowingly, thinking it was one of hers, and that's how it ended up in the pits. That's their story. The UCI is saying it doesn't matter. You had this bike.
Yeah.
You know, we don't backstory or whatever else happened. That's fine if, you know, that's your argument for it. But the fact of the matter is you had it, so therefore you're in violation. And past that, you can go on the internet, you can go everywhere else. There are just stories coming out left and right about the family, about the bike, about everything, about $200,000 electromagnetic motorized wheels, all of this stuff that we are going to be hearing about until our ears bleed for the next year. Right now, all we know is that she's under investigation and the UCI has her bike, and nobody is denying that there was a motor in it.
Right. Like you said, Bill, it's season 3 of Serial.
Yeah. For all the stuff that you're seeing, it's just amazing. And again, I don't even want to get in all the like crap that's out there. It's easy to find, but it's just nuts.
That's why I brought up the bird theft. People can look up the bird theft on their own.
Yeah.
Here's my feelings on this. This is obviously a violation of the rule, because if you read the rule, it says, it doesn't even say you have to have ridden the bike. It says, in fact, David and I were looking at it this morning. It just says the bike, it doesn't even have to be on the course. It just has to be in the vicinity even, right? So it's clearly a violation of the rule. The penalty rule for technical fraud is 12.1.013, which is, means 6-month suspension minimum and between 20,000 and 200,000 Swiss franc fine. My thing on the whole deal is, I don't buy the friend's bike, whatever. It's like this. It was not a 19-year-old girl that orchestrated this.
Thank you. Yes.
Right. There is no way you're going to make me think that a 19-year-old girl on her own went and orchestrated putting an electric motor in her bike. You know, if nothing else, her mechanic that picks up the pit bike would have to be like, holy crap, what's the anchor that's in this bike? So, you know, that is my biggest issue is I don't want to see Femke turned into the symbol of evil in everything that there is about mechanical doping, because it wasn't just her. There's no way.
It's also unfortunate that it's women's racing, because I've already seen two separate cartoons making fun of women on bikes and having motors. So that's an unfortunate part of it as well. And the other thing that now is happening, and again, I think that this is going on. I am not a denier here. I believe that there have people who have raced with motors in their bikes 100%. But now what I just sort of roll my eyes at is I've gotten from two different people, one of them ended up on the internet, these clips showing other racers and how they must have had motors in their bikes.
I mean, we're going back to what, 2010? with Spring Classics with motorized bikes, right?
Right. You had Cancellara. You know, I think the most damning one, the one that was crazy, was Ryder Hesjedal's bike just continuing
just
to spin on the
him.
Ground. That one was just nuts, but evidently there was an explanation for it. I don't know if they actually looked inside of his bike for that, but...
Or too much Jack Daniels the night before or something like
right,
that.
Right. You know, and that's the other thing that people now are debating, and there seems to be this push for lifetime bans for people who have motors in their bikes, and it's this, it comes down to this very technical argument in that, because everybody says, well, dopers should get lifetime bans too, which, you know, I may not disagree with, but they're saying, well, the UCI doesn't control doping, that's WADA. The UCI does control its own rules, so they could have a hard stand here in what they can control and say, if you're caught with a motor in your bike, you can never race bikes again, where they're not at the point where they can do that with people who dope because they don't control those rules.
And I'm sorry, I don't agree. I personally, I don't agree with the lifetime ban thing. I think for this exact reason, I don't think this 19-year-old girl should not be able to race ever again in her life. Do I think there should be a penalty and a suspension? Absolutely. I mean, no question about that. But I don't think her racing career should be over. And I certainly don't agree with, you know, like you said, Bill, like guys like, you know, Eddie Merckx coming on there like he's on some pedestal of, you know, oh, this mechanical doping should be a lifetime ban. You know, it's so much worse than the chemical doping, in parentheses, that we used to do. You know, that's just, I don't like that, as if he's, you know, there's some moral high ground that someone like them, that he can take. So I don't agree with the lifetime ban personally. I like a 4-year ban is what all doping should entail, but we could, you know, that's a whole nother discussion.
The point you said before, you know, I agree. She's 90. She is old enough to be able to make her own decisions, but maybe she's not. And maybe we don't know what kind of pressure she's in. Again, if you go back and you can do whatever searches you can on her family and everything else that's out there, I think that not condoning what she did, not giving her a pass, but I can only imagine she's in a really hard position with this.
Yes.
Okay, I'll tell you, because you asked for my opinion almost.
Yeah, David, what's your opinion?
Hey,
I'll
David.
Tell you where I'm
David,
here.
Are you here?
I'm on the right side. This is where I sit on this. Of all these people that are yelling, oh, it's worse than chemical doping or, you know, physical of the rider, I have quite the opposite opinion on this.
Yeah, so do
I think that looking at it, if you were to go out there and you could race cleanly, by starting as a junior, doping to the gills for maybe 5-6 years, and build yourself into this amazing cycling, you know, god or goddess, and then stop doping. So now you're racing clean and start your racing career later in life, but then have this base that was built on false pretenses. Whereas here, once you pull that equipment away from that person, yes, there has to be some penalty, but once you pull that equipment away from them, they're no longer being able to ride the coattails of that doping.
Yeah. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
When you're building your base on chemical success, sure, you ban me for 4 years, I'll come back in 5 and be still have some level of fitness based on that the fraud that I committed as a junior or, you know, in younger times.
Right.
That's where I think this is all silly.
Did either of y'all watch The Simpsons, especially like early on?
Wait, like when it first started?
Well, there was I don't know when it was, and I didn't watch much of it, but I definitely saw this episode, and it just got stuck into my head after this. It was called Maximum Homer Drive, because I actually went and looked it up, and it's when Homer became a truck driver.
No, I didn't.
And he soon learned that there was this little device in the truck that actually drove the truck for him. So that's how these guys could do, you know, 17 hours straight of driving and look like this whole, you know, like they were doing amazing things. And then he exposed all of the other truck drivers that basically they were truck doping. And they all came after him, and it was like this whole Omerta thing. It's just crazy. If you go back and watch this, I'm like, this is like bike racing right now. And then at the end, all of the truckers are together after Homer escapes, and the guy's like, hey, you know, maybe we should just get back and drive like our dads used to drive. And of course, one of them says, you mean drunk? He's like, no, without any fancy gizmos or anything, just using our own skills and our own, you know, technique. And they all look at each other and nod, and then one of the guys goes, nah, we'll just look for the next scam. You know, so go look up Maximum Homer Drive, and then you can.
I have to check that out. Along the same line, you know, these news organizations, you know, this is what drives me crazy too. You know, this is all over every news, Yahoo News, all these things everybody's talking about. It's like, you know, that just kind of pisses me off to some point too. It's like, you know, let's not talk about this, the Evie Richards story, you know, this British rider who, you know, race doesn't come out of England for cross and then comes and wins the world championship. That wouldn't even be on anybody's radar. But as soon as this happens, every one of these people are covering it. And I don't know. That just rubs me the wrong way.
If you are a cycling site and that's what you are only covering. No, that's what I'm saying. Then no. No, I see the opposite. If you are a cycling site and all you can do is post updates about stuff that is just conjecture, there aren't even any facts about this, you know, motor doping, then I hold that against you. For the people who are getting upset that cyclocross is finally in the national eye and this is the way that people see it, yeah, I agree. It's not good. But here is the key. Nobody cares about cyclocross in the national eye. It's not going to become the fifth major sport in the U.S. No. It's not like if they had just seen it for what it is, all of a sudden we'd have 30,000 people showing up to races. No, it wasn't going to happen. So this story will be here, and people are like, look at those goofy guys on bikes and look at the stupid thing, how they're, you know, putting motors in there. And then the Super Bowl will happen, and then nobody will care again.
Or actually, any NFL Sunday will happen.
Yeah, yeah.
Doesn't even have to be the
Super Bowl. It just happens that the next one's going to be the Super Bowl. So
right.
And even the closest to mainstream media fan we had was, what, the Wall Street Journal?
Yeah, Jason Gay.
Jason Gay, who called it, what, the goofiest scam ever?
Yeah, that's when I started finding GIFs of, like, end zone dances. I was like, yeah, because guys in tights and shoulder pads dancing around isn't goofy at all.
Right.
Yeah.
Makes total sense.
Yeah.
All right, guys, let's move on.
David wanted to do last week's races, too, because he didn't think we were going to have enough content.
Yeah. So No, I do have to say that I am the only one of the three of us who's brave enough and politically incorrect enough to call for a national ban on all cyclists coming to the U.S. until we can get this straightened out.
Okay.
I just want to throw that out there. I'm also announcing my candidacy for the presidency.
For the Republican Party president.
Are you going to build a wall without any cycling ramps on it?
I am going to build that wall. And it's not going to be a flyover, and the Belgians are going to pay for it.
All right. With that.
With that, the flyovers at Zolder always are just amazing. They have the best flyovers. They have
three-story building.
They have three levels to them. You go down a descent, and then you make a right turn on two of them. It's just nuts.
They're like double-tiered where you climb plateau and then climb again.
Oh, those seem like they just hurt too. And it's the type of thing where we always say, oh, if you saw it in person,
you'd realize how
steep it really is. Yet when you see them on TV, especially the one that comes out of the woods, which we also have to talk about, that there are actual woods they're riding through, that thing looks steep on TV.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And they are struggling up it.
Yeah.
That's just.
So the suspense was building for us as we're watching through the day. Like we said, junior race was good. The U23 women's race was a little bit better. We had the drama with Evie Richards. Everyone was getting excited. Little did we know what we were about to see in the elite women's race. That race freaking blew my mind. What about you guys?
It was definitely a surprise. And and isn't it the winner somebody who is eligible for the U23 race?
Yes, she is 23. Her racing age is 23.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
All right.
But close. I mean, well, I'm talking not just the winner, but that last lap of that race with those five women.
Well, that was the thing. Is
trading
that
punches and body blows and just, I mean, I was just in shock.
Our biggest, for the three of us and fans of the sport, the biggest fear that you have in a cyclocross race is something similar to what Evie Richards did and something similar to what Decker did. It's get out early and then we're just watching one person ride around the course.
Yeah, by themselves. Yeah.
This was the complete opposite of that.
Oh, man. So, all right, well, we'll give the top five. So the first place was Thalita de Jong from the Netherlands. Second place was Caroline Mani from France. Third place, Sanne Kant from Belgium. Fourth place, Sophie De Boer from the Netherlands. And fifth place was Nikki Harris from Great Britain. So how do we even want to like start describing this? To me, ride of that race was Caroline Mani. I mean, what Thalita de Jong did was incredible. I mean, she comes from way behind. She's like the, you know, in my head, Bill, I'm thinking of the Jaws music from the Svennis.
Yeah.
You know, when I watch that, you can see her helmet kind of in the background, slowly tracking down and getting closer.
21 seconds back at one point.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like, oh, man, she's here she comes. But to me, the rider that I was really excited about and really just cheering on was Caroline Mani. I mean, what a great ride she had. But all the top five, I mean, Sanne Kant was right there too, just, you know, battling out Sophie De Boer, Nikki Harris. And we talk about the running. I think one of the things that was clear right here was that when Nikki Harris was in the front, Caroline Mani was able to run her down on foot. Did you guys agree with that?
I see that. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Comments?
Lots of them. One, we haven't talked about the uphill off camber section, which is just probably my favorite feature in cyclocross because there are so many options.
Uh-huh.
You have these two, you know, you come across, you go up one climb, make a left turn, then across, and then make a right turn. Nikki Harris with the early move of the day going all the way to the top of the wall before the off camber even came. And then once she started leading, everybody followed suit. And then it's, you know, that's just so much fun because you don't know how they're going to attack it every lap. And as you know, we get to our later races, it's something that was a factor in the men's race, but the women were just trying everything, and it was sloppy. It was super sloppy. So even though I think all of them knew that if they got to the very top, that was an easier line, but it was so slippery that they were all having to dismount. I think Mani, didn't she always go up high? Or
yeah, I think so. Or it was definitely her.
Yeah,
her line
but
of
they
choice.
Were definitely yeah. like split, and it was just such a great feature.
Thing that's so cool about that feature, or one of the things, is like you said, you know, they get separated, so it looks like there's a gap or something, and then it all comes back together at the end, and it's like, so you're judging the whole time. Was that better than that? And who's going faster? And then they all pinch back together at the top, and they're either together or someone was able to gain a gap. I agree with you, Bill. That's one of the best features in all of cyclocross for sure.
And then
in particular this week, based on the mud and the ever-changing conditions, that outside line really changed lap to lap. The outside, you know, far right to go to the top.
Oh, yes, yes.
Became, if you look at where that rut kept moving until it was almost under the fence line.
Yeah. Yeah, you'd see different people stall at that point at different times throughout the weekend. So that point, I think, was changing as far as its rideability goes. But, you know, and then remember, too, the spot where Nikki Harris just, it was so weird how she, like, completely lost her momentum, you know, where she kind of got stopped and was just kind of off balance and flat-footed and kind of, like, paused.
Yes.
It seemed like forever. I'm sure it was only a couple seconds.
That was just,
but it was like,
it was gut-wrenching.
Oh, my God.
And that was an interesting turn, and it was one that so many just cool thing. We did me and a couple other folks did a live broadcast simulcast of the races, and when we were doing the men's races, because of things like that, because of the off cambers, the New York Velocity people on Twitter were referring to every time we went nuts over those things as line choice boners. I love how the CX Hairs guys have line choice boners in their broadcast. It's like that's pretty perfect. And yes.
Yeah, they don't understand that we get excited about this.
Yeah, but that was the thing, is like that one post where Nikki got bogged. It was Nikki Harris, right? Yeah, got bogged down. So everybody caught up with her. Had a 4 or 5 second lead. Everybody just caught right up with her at that point. That just changed. You know, it's such a thinking game. You have to know. They have to be able to change your plan lap to lap, and that definitely in that women's race was happening.
Yeah, yeah, and let's not give it up to, I mean, not forget Thalita De Jong and the ride that she had. I mean, like I said, Caroline Mani is still, I think, my favorite in that race. But man, she's cool, and we've been watching her in the late parts of the season. You guys, we've been talking about her in our other shows. We were showing how, you know, she was getting in the, you know, top five, top three here and there, and how strong she was looking. And man, she just put it all together for this race for sure.
What I got fixated on in this race was Sabrina Stoltens, because she was in no man's land most of this race. She was right off the front group and just always dangling back there. And then it looked like she finally was going to make contact. And then just out of nowhere, like, oh, there she is. Wait, that's not even her. That's another Dutch woman that came out of nowhere.
Sophie De Boer.
Sophie De Boer was up.
Sophie
in
De Boer was up
group.
There, but it was these. It was if
when,
you
when
always
De Jong
look.
Came
yeah,
out.
It was De Jong. Yeah. You looked behind and was always Stoltens there. And then all of a sudden this bolt came around in the same kit. You're like, is that Stoltens? No, who's that?
Yeah.
And then I'm thinking,
well, she might pull Stoltens up with her. There might be three Dutch, you know, women in that front group. It didn't happen, but man, oh man. And you guys, well, let's talk about Sané Kant too. Did you guys? I did feel sorry for Sané Kant at the end at the awards when she just kind of broke down. You know, and you just kind of get this idea that she's just got to be thinking to herself, you know, what else do I got? What else do I got to do?
I understand that this is a publicly broadcast sport, and that the cameras are everywhere. But man, that backstage camera just always, I'm just like, just Just get out of her face. She's breaking down. She's in tears. I mean, it's like,
yeah.
And anybody that criticizes her for crying on the podium is just nuts.
That's bullshit.
Here's my hypocrisy of that. People are like, she's got to suck it up and be a pro. I did not hear one person complain that Carolyn Monnier was crying on the podium.
Yeah, right.
Both of them were crying on the podium. Monnier was just like so freaking stoked to be there that she couldn't contain herself.
Yeah.
And on the other side, Kant was just like devastated that 2 years in a row she wasn't able to do what she set out to do.
Yeah. It's like you're only allowed to get to show positive emotions on the podium. If you show, you know, disappointing emotions, no, we don't want emotions on the podium.
And it wasn't like she's, you know, and I hate the whole bitch face thing. I don't even like saying it because I just think it's offensive. And
it's,
you can show emotion. She wasn't being disrespectful to anybody. She
not
sat
at
up
all.
There. She got
to me,
on the podium.
That's a clear piece of the difference this year from last year. You know, it was truly, I got beat and I'm upset and I poured my heart and my whole body into this and I'm overwhelmed, as opposed to, oh, Deleted the Young doesn't deserve to win. And I'm not saying this is how she perhaps came across last year. Might not have been her underlining, you know, truth and meaning, but last year she had this sense of, well, did the winner deserve to win because she came in and, you know, PFP is not a true cyclocrosser all season long.
To me, this
was a different set of emotions.
Listening to what Kant said, she said that she was less disappointed than last year because the leader was just stronger.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Whereas last year she felt like she made a mistake.
Yeah, and she just, you know, it came down to the sprint and she got out sprinted, but yeah, that I think that she thought that she could have raced a better race and beaten Ferran Prevot, and I think that she just doesn't, you know, she didn't. It was the whole thing that she just came in late in the season, and you know, there was that part of it, which is fine, you know.
Yeah,
but that's just sort of how it works out, and the fastest person's gonna win. But yeah.
Okay, so Americans in the elite women's race: Katie Antoneau was eighth, Katie Compton was 13th. Ellie Anderson was 14th, Meredith Miller 23rd, Amanda Miller 24th, Crystal Anthony 32nd. We haven't even talked about the Americans.
Can we go ahead, Bill? Can we include Carolyn Monnier in there?
Some people say you should.
Well, you know, and that's one of the things I actually have in my notes is this idea that you have to live in Europe to be competitive in Europe. I mean, I would say between Katarina Nash last year and Caroline Mani this year, it's like, at least in elite women's cyclocross, I don't know how true that is.
You don't think Georgia Gold would have been up there as well?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, absolutely. She would have. So I think that this helps dispel that myth. Like I said, I think there could be a difference between elite women's cyclocross and elite men's cyclocross. So, but I think those two ladies and, like you say, Georgia Gould would definitely put a chink in that, at least in that argument for the elite women in cyclocross.
Yeah, and Michael Dick as well. Great ride by her in 16th.
Yeah. So
that said, I think it's a different animal too, because women have been racing outside of Belgium and competitively so, whereas in Belgium and in some of the traditional European cyclocross countries, there's perhaps some disincentive for women to make it up to the elite ranks. So it may not be so important to be racing in Europe as a woman to be in those top ranks.
Well, I think it's important to race in Europe. I don't know that it's that you have to live there and have grown up there and that kind of stuff. That's my point. I think, yeah, it is important that you race there, which, you know, Caroline Monnier and Katarina Nash the last 2 years obviously did a lot of. But this idea that you got to live there, at least for the women, I think this is definitely evidence that that might
be. Right, but you can also see, which has been the case for a while, if you look at the top men versus the top women, top men, it's a pretty even split between the Dutch and the Belgians. If you look at the women, the Dutch are up there, right?
Right.
You got
Frieda
Jong, you got Sophie de Boer, Stoltens, Sanna Vipassan in her last race, all up there. The next Belgian rider is Ellen Van Looy at 18th.
Yeah.
So it's a little different animal from men to women as far as the focus for Belgian cycling.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think, like I said, I think the argument could be different for men, but I think, you know, this is just kind of evidence that for women, at least, that might not be so true. But I got to ask you guys one other thing, too. Were you guys, like, at the start of that race, Katie Compton finally gets a good start?
Oh, jeez.
I was like,
I knew that
oh,
would
my
be
God.
A bad sign. Yes.
She nailed that. She's going. And then they do that kind of that little jog, and then they hit that first turn, and she goes down.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh.
How many potential rules does that first turn break for the UCI? your first turn is not supposed to be a 180, and they always say, well, it's not really the first turn because the course sort of turns before that a little bit gradually. And then
and
second,
it's not really a 180. It's really a 170.
Yeah, they had some suspect interpretations of the 180 rule on that course. Again, Hoogerheide just broke the rule, right? That was a race that they were just... No, it was the French race.
Oh,
the French race with the maze there.
With just one 180 after the other. It's like the UCI just threw up their hands and left. It's like we're not changing
that race.
This.
That was what did Tim Johnson call that? A spaghetti course?
Right.
I mean, that was craziness, man. But anyways, that was funny. But I just
Compton going down there, you're just like, oh, jeez.
You gotta be kidding me. And I don't know if that was the cause, but she didn't, you know, she never kind of regained it. Compton was my pick for second. I actually had two out of the three of my picks on the podium, at least. I mean, I had I picked Monty for third and Compton for second. So I was close there with Monty. So. All right, guys, do we have anything else we want to say about the women's race, elite women? So we finished off Saturday and like in this amazing race and, you know, the Dutch have two wins and a third place, and Belgium has one third place. We're like, whoa.
One Belgian on the podium. They were not happy.
Plus
an enormous scandal.
And an enormous scandal about the whole team. Right, basically.
So maybe this is a place to bring that up with part of – because there's two sanctions that get imposed for – according to the rules. One is against the rider. The other is against the rider's team. Clearly, this seems to be written towards like just road racing where you're racing with the trade team. But who is this woman's Femke's team? Is that the Belgian national U23 women's team or the Belgian women's team? Or is it the Belgian national team?
I don't know. Does she have a trade? I'm sure she's on some sort of trade team
She does have a trade team as well.
Yeah.
But she wasn't racing for the trade team. Her jersey was the Belgian national team.
Yeah, I think my interpretation of that UCI rule is that it's a team. If the team commits an infraction as a team, like I think it was when they wrote that, they were thinking mostly of road cycling. So if your team is caught mechanically doping with like on a team time trial or something like that, or even if just like all your entire members of all your team were caught, then that was the penalty for that. Not that if a single person committed this infraction, then I think that's what that first part of the rule is. And then if it's an entire team, it goes to the second part of the rule. So I don't necessarily think in my reading of the rule that just because one person does something incredibly stupid that the whole team is penalized in this instance. I don't think that was the way I read the rule. So I think it's, you know, I'm sure there's an official interpretation that the UCI is going to go through and, you know, and they'll have to figure all that out.
So we'll leave this to you, Bill. So you'll splice in Brian Cookson's call later.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we head into Saturday, and I don't know about you guys, but I'm thinking on Saturday, I'm thinking there's nothing is going to top what we saw in the women's race. It's just not going to happen. That was just incredible race. I was still like buzzing from it. And then I'll never forget your tweet, Bill. I think it was like in all caps about, what is going on in this race? We get to the men's.
I believe there may have been some expletives at the beginning of it. and a holy.
We get to the men's U23 race. Let's give the results first. You guys want to give the results first? In first place was Eli Easerbeet, somebody who listeners of this show will know we have been talking about.
I learned something from from the crowd.
Ellie?
Yes, Ellie.
I know, but out of respect of our history, I just want to say Eli.
Okay, I'm good with that.
In second place, Adam Tupalik. I was going to try and throw some...
he was in first place of the penultimate lap.
I was going to throw some witty comment in there, but I couldn't come up with anything. Third place, Quentin Hermans. In fourth place, Thies Aerts. In fifth place, Clement Russo. So... Well, first of all, one of the really kind of dramatic moments in this race was that crash.
Yes.
Who was it? I can't think. I'm like drawing a blank.
Who was it? Dutch rider.
Yes. Leading the race, and I'm drawing a blank on his name. Hits the pavement and just completely wipes it out. Non-drive side. Luckily, goes down sliding across the pavement. And basically just can't get his head back in it, I think, after that point. And the rest of the field catches up. But the big drama is, of course, people probably already know this, is Tupalek comes in with one lap to go, sits up, raises his arms as this incredibly loud one lap to go bell is ringing. He's raising his arms as if he won, and the entire field just comes up, catches, and passes him.
Well,
and away they go. They're still
even
one
before that. If you go back and watch it again, the most cringeworthy part of the whole celebration of him pumping his hands and hitting his chest is that he looks back and points at Easerbeet and Dan Soda and whoever else were there who are like seconds behind since he put in this enormous effort, and like points at them like to just as if he just showed them something, and they all just look at him like, what are you doing, as they ride by him. and then the fans on the side are doing this like circular motion with their finger, like, you need to keep going. No. You need to keep going. And he does it back to them. He's like, yeah. And he makes this little gesture back to them. And they're just, it was so hard to watch.
I didn't feel quite as bad for him when I did see that kind of as a replay the second time I watched it through. It was almost some taunting there.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
that's what made it that much worse. Is like he was almost taunting these guys that they couldn't keep up with them, and they're like, "Well, no, because the race isn't over."
That's right.
That all being said,
yes,
had that not happened, he might have still been the strongest rider in that field.
Well, he proved he was the strongest rider.
He fought his way back up to the group, and was a factor in the sprint at the end.
Well, here's a couple things. One. He could have quit at that point. So,
yes, true.
You know, and second sort of thrown in there, I thought he was, after maybe getting a little exuberant and taunting the people behind him, if you want to call it that, his press conference, he was great. And he called himself the biggest idiot out there and was just, you know, made no excuses for what he did, lost his focus. What I did appreciate was that after making this enormous error that is going to be replayed for the rest of his racing career.
I mean, it's going to be a phrase. It's going to be called pulling a Tupalek.
Yes. He was able to refocus. He was able to refocus, chase down the group of some of the fastest racers in the world, get back on their wheel, and then dictate that last lap. I mean, I'm sure a lot of it was, once he figured it out, was adrenaline, and I'm sure he burned a lot of matches, if he even had any left, getting back to that group. But once he caught them, he was pushing the pace.
Yeah, I mean, and I expected to see what we typically see is someone do that. They get that adrenaline burst, they catch them, and then they die. And that did not happen. He caught them, stayed with them, and started to dictate the pace, like
you
said.
And then Easerbeet, who is an exceptionally smart racer, even that, you know, he said he wasn't on a great day, and he was one that while the race was going on I was worried about because we didn't see him. He was nowhere to be seen. You know, it was a very Sven-like appearance by Easerby. Oh. He just kept coming up, and he was about 10 seconds down and 9 seconds down, and all of a sudden, there he was in this front group. And
I have written in my notes, Bill, is it sacrilege for me to say who he reminds me of with the way he wrote that race?
Yeah. No.
Because that's exactly what I was thinking. Very Sven-like race by him.
Yeah, and then once... He could almost see, as I was talking about, that adrenaline and Tupolik just pushing it, and he just calmly sat there in second and third place and then finally took the lead, was able to get a bit of a gap so that him and Tupolik were separated from third place, and then which was Hermann's, and, and then it just came down to a sprint. And that's the amazing thing. Tupolik was still there. I mean, that race was not decided until within 50 meters of the finish line.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And then, and you know, and they were a good 4 seconds above Hermann. So, you know, Tupolik and Easerby were the strongest two left in the race, despite Tupolik having to go through all that at the end. So, yeah, I mean, man, like I said, we didn't think it could get any better after the elite women in here. And even before he did that on the with the one lap to go, it was a great race up until that point. I mean, those guys were really... It was just back and forth, too, and there was all kinds of really great cyclocross racing through that whole race. Yes?
Felipe Orts from Spain. Great race by him, sixth place.
Great to see him in there, absolutely.
And he was leading the race in the early laps.
Yeah,
and a little bit of fancy pants on the jumps there.
Yeah, little whip it, little whip action.
Yeah. It's the Vanderpool whip action there.
Right behind him, Gioli Bertolini, I think probably a little disappointed. He had a hard crash at the flyover. You know, I think the same place that you know, we'll talk about in the men's elite that late in the race, there were, I think, the undoing of one of our favorites, the second undoing of one of our favorites in the men's elite race. But, yeah, he endoed going up that. You know, I think there's a little bit of a lip. And these guys are pushing, so you're basically sprinting onto that flyover since it's so steep. And yeah, he ate it pretty hard, and I think that probably cost him, well, top five if not a chance at the podium.
Yeah, I think it just he was completely rattled after that and didn't look the same after that. Let's just mention the Americans really quick.
Can I just say before we do Americans, the one biggest surprise for me, and I'm sure for you all once I mention the name, Simon Andreasen. Who?
Oh yeah,
you know the junior world champion just not strong enough. So here's an interesting point: if you go back to last year, the battle Simon Andreasen, a Danish rider, came out of nowhere and just crushed into Boer, and everybody thought that Easerbeet was going to win. Easerbeet was still in the juniors. This guy's still in the juniors. Simon Andreasen ends up just running away with it. Comes into this race. This is Easerbeet first year in the U23 field. That's the amazing thing. This is his first year.
Yeah, he's 19.
19 years old. Gets to race. We thought maybe it'd be another showdown between him and Andreasen, who is just a man and so strong, but did not turn out to be. But just the jump from Easerbeet going from juniors to U23, dominating that in the World Cup and then winning the World Championship is pretty darn amazing. It'll be interesting to see what he does next year.
Yeah. I saw a great tweet, and you probably saw it too, Bill, and someone said, when Wout van Aert has nightmares, they are of Eli Easerbeet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that's who's coming, man. Not anybody. It's like nobody else in the elite men's field really worries him, but Easerbeet is like coming for him. It's kind of the...
Which is just cool. Insane that he is only a year younger than Vanderpool.
Yeah. All right, let's do Americans. Logan Owen, 13th. Curtis White, 18th. Drew Dillman, 27th. Grant Elwood, 33rd. And Tobin Ortenblatt, 35th. I thought it was really cool. Curtis came off the line like he was shot out of a gun, man.
Yeah, whole shot. It was pretty nice.
And just totally controlled the beginning of that race.
He wanted to make sure that Emma wasn't the only one who got a whole shot in a big European race this year.
And yeah, just flying off the front of that. So that was kind of cool to see. Didn't really see too much of Logan Owen. He was just kind of out of camera range, I think, as they kind of panned back through the field. You kind of used to, you know, you could see Logan Owen kind of peeking in here and there at the back of the frame when they were going around turns and stuff. But overall, pretty good. I think Logan wanted to be top 10 for sure. So I think he was a little bit disappointed by that. But great job by these guys overall. You know, it's tough, and I think they did a good job.
Yep, I agree.
Certainly. And I think, you know, one of the things that Curtis White did with that hole shot and that going off the front, that was a very successful strategy earlier in the weekend. And things might have played out very differently.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, they were definitely in the early stages of most every race, if not all-out crashes, bottlenecks just all over the place. You know, it was yeah. Basically, if you were you had to be in that top 20 or top 15 to do anything unless you were Thalita Dijon.
Yep. Right. All right, let's move on to the elite men. That is the of the second day. That is, of course, the main event. Well, let's just start by giving the top five again. That's a good place to start. Or do you want to talk about the race?
I'll tell you what, before you go to the race, there's something about the setup of the race. And as a race director, race promoter, I get it. I understand it.
I was
going to,
yep, please go. Yes.
But 4 hours of, yes. Or 3 hours, what was the break between? 3 hours of, please go to our tents and drink as much beer as you can.
Yep.
And then come back and be good, civilized citizen fans is a lot to ask.
Yes.
So
I agree.
If you go by U.S. East Coast times, on Saturday there were three races. There was a 5:50 a.m. race. There was a 6:50.
Yes.
6:50.
Yeah. Yep.
And then they took a little bit of a break, and then an 8:50. So those were the three time slots for Saturday. For Sunday, you only have two races, so you're like, okay, well, you just don't start as early. No. They keep the morning one, take out the middle one, that just becomes beer time, and then have the late race. So, yeah, everybody was lit by the time the men's elite race showed up. So 8 hours in front of us, so you're looking at like 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah.
I mean, some guys were so drunk that they couldn't even hold their beer. It kept spilling on one racer or another.
Only one's wearing orange, though.
It kept spilling on Dutch riders, just out of coincidence. Huh.
Yeah.
One of the things, though, that the big time gap did allow me to do is watch the U23 race, watch Drew, and then still have time to drive up to Alma, who we were all hosted at the Big B Coffee shop in Alma, who is a sponsor of the Alma GP cyclocross race. Dude, they let us come in, push tables around, bring in a projector, project the race up on the wall on a Sunday morning, which is, you know, pretty busy for them, and all hang out. We had guys there with cowbells and all kinds of stuff, Belgian jerseys and stuff, sitting there in the Big B Coffee projecting the cyclocross race on the wall and screaming our guts out.
That's awesome.
How
That's
awesome
great.
Is
yeah.
that?
I think that happened a lot around. We were, before we came up with this broadcast idea, we were thinking about doing the same at our coffee shop sponsor.
Yeah, so it was very cool to see the coffee shop that sponsors the local cyclocross race allow that to happen, and it was just great. So big thank you to Big B Coffee and Alma. So, all right, so the finishing five, the top five in the elite men's race, in first place was Wout van Aert from Belgium. Second place, Lars van Haar from the Netherlands. Third place, Kevin Powels from Belgium.
Who? Wait, he was in the race?
Fourth place, Sven Nys from Belgium, and fifth place, Matthew Vanderpool from the Netherlands. Why do you say that? You didn't see Kevin Powels?
Mainly because of the end, in that he had the position of coming in right before Sven. So sort of saw the top of his head come across the line, but then the cameras quickly panned in on Sven
Waving
to the crowd and blowing kisses in his final world championship race.
Not his final race, everybody. I've seen that so many times. It's like, no.
Two very large entities that publicly made that mistake and had to walk those back. We won't name
that
names.
That said, Bill, what happened with Matthew Vanderpool, who was in third place? It looked like he might have even been able to chase back to the silver medal.
Yeah, not to jump ahead, but we will. So Vanderpool, you know, we'll talk about it. Big dust up during the race. At the end, he was starting to gain back a couple of factors. One, he said he just wasn't on a good day to start, which you know, before the drama happened, you could sort of see that it wasn't his normal, smell you guys later. I'm going off the front and see if you can hold my wheel. So there was that. I think that after he made a huge effort to try to get back to the front group, he just said he didn't have anything left. And then he had an issue much where Bertolini crashed on that final huge flyover.
Yeah.
He had the word is that he had some more issues there, and that's where Pals and Sven were able to get around him, and after that he was just done.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, basically implying he was in it to win it, and it didn't at that point, the bronze really didn't matter.
Right, right. So, I mean, it was a great race coming off. What do you guys want to talk about at the start of this race?
In much that we talked about Katie Compton, I mean, we have to talk about Jeremy Powers.
Yeah, starting on the first.
Pretty disappointing race from Jeremy Powers.
It's heartbreaking. He was there. He was ready. He felt like he was
on
good form. Row one start, which I'm not. There's like this whole debate out there on whether he deserves to be on the front row. He does. He has the points.
He
also, and what nobody will mention is he also got sixth place at a World Cup. So he has performed in the World Cups, you know. So that aside, that's for another day. He missed his pedal. Completely missed his pedal.
Yeah.
You know, coming off
Bill,
the line.
Maybe you could send him a copy of your book, Skills, Drills, and Belly Aches.
Evidently, he just needs to read up again. No, it's I don't even joke about it because I just feel horrible for him. You know, it's like two races in a row. You know, the race before at Hoogerheide, he gets, it's like friendly fire. He gets run into the barriers because Wout and Vanderpool are like so going after each other. Wout leans into Vanderpool, who swerves into Powers, who has to. Has to check up, and that was the thing that he felt worse about, is that he was forced to grab his brakes and put everybody behind him in jeopardy, but it was either that or run into the barriers. So
and again
not to get into these internet arguments that anybody who's like, well, he should have just pushed them back, go line up on a World Cup race
and
you know,
good luck with that.
Yeah.
And put yourself in that same position. Your Cat 3 race, you know, is not the same.
And sometimes you're just slightly out of position to do that. You know what I mean? It's not just always you can push right back. You know, when guys have a little bit of advantage on you or something, it's not just always about all you got to do is push them back.
And here's
no,
the
that
thing.
Doesn't always
here's
work
the thing way. That no one said. Why didn't Matthew Vanderpool push back?
True.
He's the guy that got pushed over and that Powers had to react to. So why isn't he elbowing him back?
Exactly. I got going back to the U23 race. I got to tell you, because I tend to watch where Drew is at the beginning of the races. And if you guys see when the U23 field comes past the pits for the first time, if you get a chance, go back and watch this. They come by. Drew is riding on the left part of the line as they come by the pits, by like those boards that were there. I don't know if you saw those boards. Yeah, Drew is riding up there. They go into that turn, and just as they're about to exit the camera, I don't know who it is, but another rider tries to lean into him in that turn, and Drew totally just like holds his line. You see him, he like pushes his elbow out and forces this kid. He's almost like, no, you're not going there, and I'm not giving in to you. And I was like, oh my God, that was so, even though, you know, they're riding like 23rd at this point, but I was just like, oh my God, that was awesome.
Yeah,
I even have
a clip of a World Cup race from last year from Powers in the start that I use when we do these live presentations with him, where he does exactly what everybody wants him to do. I guess I should bring that out, where he just like, there's a guy trying to come into him because he's getting pushed the guy is getting pushed into the pits and tries to get into Powers, and he's like, uh-uh, and just throws this huge bow at him and just basically arm bars him back out of his way so he can keep his line, and then that guy was forced to go into the pits.
Yeah, 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 exactly. So it's not just always about, well, you just got to push back. No,
right.
It's not always that.
So. Anyway, moving
all right,
on.
So, to me, the first factor that really stands out in this race, obviously, is the incident, which was just crazy. We see Vanderpool going into that. It was that off camber thing that we were talking about earlier.
The
right,
most
Bill?
Exciting feature, because all the lines that you can choose, and Vanderpool was sketchy every time through there. He went up there one time, and you know how he does that little whip, you know, intentionally or unintentionally, he whips into the chain link fence and knocks himself off of his bike.
I was like, oh my God.
One of the next times he gets up really high, can't go anymore, doesn't want to dismount, and like shoots back down to that lower line.
Yes.
That was a nuts move. And then a couple laps later, he is trying to get up there, gets it completely wrong, goes down. Van Aert is right behind him, runs into the back of him, and then what happens?
Yeah, he puts his left foot down, his right foot kind of comes over the bike, the saddle, and hits Wout's wheel just right where his foot goes completely through the wheel.
And gets stuck. And they are, to their credit, neither got mad. They are both, I mean, Wout's banging on his wheel, though, and grabbing Van Aert's leg, trying to force it out of his wheel.
I think at first there was that sense of Vanderpool just pulling his leg and Wout just pulling his bike.
Right.
Right.
And then there was that, wait a minute, this isn't working.
We need to
cooperate to get this thing fixed.
Right.
And I think I counted 12 seconds from beginning to end that they were there.
I believe that. Yeah.
Wrestling.
In about six places.
Yeah. And
at least.
So while that's going on, Lars Vanderhaar, who made a really nice move to get out front right before that, you know, call it smart, call it lucky, took that way high line, which he had taken every lap, rode it cleanly, and then he was gone.
Yes.
And then the race was on. So it was Lars Vanderhaar, who has won on this course before, has outsprinted Zdeněk Stybar on this course, is confident that he can win a race here, and he is now out front with nobody behind him.
What was his gap right there? Was it like 12 seconds?
Yeah.
I want to say 12
seconds.
13,
I believe.
What the GPS thing was showing. So he's off, out and away, and then it's Powell's. Who was chasing? Powell's. Wout was Wout immediately the next hour? How did Wout get in front of being the first chaser? I think he caught Powell's.
No, Wout was a good 9 seconds back for a while.
Yeah. So it took him a little time to get up with the guys that were chasing Lars.
Right.
But and then eventually he was in front of him, obviously, and chasing Lars down. And then it was just like, we're watching the time as they go around, and he's slowly reeling Lars in, and you're just like, oh my God, is he going to make it? Is he not going to make it? What's going to happen? Did you see, I mean, obviously, I'm going to call it the pass in the last lap was that Bigby coffee shop we were at erupted.
The feedback I got from our broadcast was we were making people's ears bleed at that point. So it's this extremely sketchy, steep, downhill, sandy, muddy with a left-hand turn at the bottom onto pavement. It's where they put up David and I's bouncy castle barriers to catch the people that get it wrong. And this
usually
is
Sven.
Yeah, and this is the type of thing that, you know, the whole race, Wout had been taking this inside line where he had unclipped his left foot and was basically dabbing the whole way down. And this is where, and I think it is legitimate criticism about Lars Vanderhaar and his remount technique and some of his other technique that could be better, but one thing that guy does better than anybody else in the world is go downhill.
Yeah.
And especially downhill off campers. That's how he won the European Championship this year. I believe Valkenburg. That's why he wins Valkenburg, because that's the skill that he is just superior on. And here it was just one of the most amazing moves out there, taking the outside line and just crushing it, passing him, a ballsy move, bombing that, passing him halfway down. Of course, everybody, I put that clip up on my Instagram if you want to see it, and then you can read through the comments, and everybody goes, "Yeah, disc brakes. That's what it is. It's disc brakes."
Yeah,
I can guarantee you, neither of those guys touched their brakes.
No. I was just going to say that.
It didn't matter. Canty.
It wasn't disc brakes. It was because they failed.
Yeah. there were no brakes being used during that 2 seconds during that descent.
Yeah. And I mean, he comes around the outside, sweeps around Wout, who had fought hard to catch him, retakes the lead on the outside, kind of nips the barrier, even the air barrier a little bit, and just goes down that pavement. To Wout's credit, though, did not shake him a bit.
No, and he comes back, and it was off the bike that he was able to outrun him and pass him back. And then after we're all singing his praises and saying that he's just riding the best ride of his life, Vanderhaar makes a huge mistake. He comes to this long run-up / ride-up. Riders were able to ride it, and
Lars was able to ride it better than Wout,
yeah,
I think.
Lars
could ride it farther.
But he could ride it best when he was in his small chain ring. Forgot to shift. Went into the last climb in his big ring, and you could see the cadence just slowing down, slowing down, slowing down. Wout also dismounted near the top, but had the momentum, kept going. Vanderhaar, both a combination of having absolutely no momentum, coming to a complete stop, and then his not great remount just cost him too much time, and that's when a couple second gap opened.
Yeah, and
before he got back on the bike, when he jumped off the bike, probably due to the large ring mistake,
and also not
was like,
yeah, and not planning to do it, and you're always gonna be slower when it's not part of your plan.
Yeah,
it's like flakes of rubber. You could see that he just, even when he was running previously, he was running better. He got off that bike, and it was almost like his legs shook when he got off the bike, and he just didn't have it.
Yeah, yeah. And, and again, like we said, Wout manages to keep that gap, extend it a little bit, I think, and he basically gets the win. First time elite world champion. Well-deserved, and like I said, when we saw the elite women's race, I was thinking at least we're never going to top this, and then this happens.
Yeah,
you got to be kidding.
An amazing race. Van Aert actually credited Vanderpool with that tangle up to sort of shake him out of whatever doldrums he was in that race, and he said that just got him on his rhythm.
Fired
him up, having to chase back. But it was, even before that, Van Aert treated this race much differently than he's treated any race during the year. What normally, and again, we talked about, Scott, when you talk about Ellie Easerbeat and how he reminds you of Sven, Wout's got that too, in that he's never going to go from the gun and lead a race. He's always going to sit in and let the race develop, and then when he knows it's his time to go and he's decided strategically it's the right time, he'll go. For this race, he changed that up, and I guarantee you it's a reaction to when Vanderpool came back for those last four World Cups that he won. Vanderpool dictates from the start, and he just goes.
Yep.
Gun goes off, Vanderpool's gone. It forced Wout out of his comfort zone early, and he just had to chase, and he had to race the whole time, and that's not what he likes to do. So complete strategy change for this World Championship. Wout van Aert in the lead in the first lap, dictating the pace.
Yeah, and the fact that Vanderpool had done that, it almost necessitates a change. You can't just keep riding the same way and getting your butt kicked like that. You got to do something. So, in my opinion, the willingness to recognize that, change your tactics, whether it works or not, whatever, you still have recognized that, okay, I got to do something different. This is not going to work if I keep doing it like this. And the ability to do that and then, hang in, circumstances dictate, his plan, comes together and he's able to do it. I got no problems with Wout and the way he won that. And I think it was just a great, and he is absolutely a legitimate world champion.
Yeah. And it's still going to be, that rivalry between him and Vanderpool, man.
Oh, yeah.
As long as Vanderpool sticks around and doesn't go to the road, that's going to be for the ages.
And it's likely that he will, for at least for some time.
And now, speaking of that, you know, too, speaking of rivalries, Matthew Vanderpool basically, like you said, said, yeah, I wasn't having a good day. His father, however, did come out and say, you know, the beer throwing and spitting and everything was like with the big beer gap in there was very bad. I mean, for both Lars Vanderhaar and for Matthew Vanderpool. Lots of bad situation with the beer throwing and the spitting.
Vanderhaar, you can. There's one shot of a full water bottle, just not like one of those plastic, you know, drinking water bottles, just coming off of his hip, ricocheting off of his hips from just being, you know, thrown from a fan, and it was awful.
Yeah, that's. It's almost like, you know, you're like, well, let's. Let's not have the Worlds in Belgium or the Netherlands if it's got to be that. You know what I mean?
And I don't think the Dutch fans are the same, though. I think this really is a specifically Belgian.
Belgian and American.
Yeah, but, you know, Americans are just being dumb and partying.
I'm joking.
I think that's the biggest thing, I think, and we've talked about that before, and I don't want to go down that road now, but those aren't fans.
I think the Vegas thing is more out of drunkenness and ignorance, and the Belgian thing is more out of drunkenness and hatred.
Yes.
Yep.
So, in both things, drunkenness is there.
and bets placed.
Yeah. Right. True. Yeah. True. All right. Well, let's do the Americans. Do you guys have the American finishers?
Oh, yes, I do. But also, I think the one rider worth mentioning in this race who finished 14th was former world champion Lars Boom. Started 54th, I believe, 51st.
That was one of his best races of the year in cross, right?
He crushed it.
I mean, he's had crappy races before.
That's an amazing effort to fight through that whole field and to finish above Francis Moret. And right behind Stan Godry in 14th place. That's a legit, you know, you figure, you give Lars, I don't know if he's racing anymore, probably not, but, you know, and he had to tour down under to put in his training for this.
Right.
That's, you know, you give him another month and he's right up there with the front guys.
Speaking of down under, I do want to mention, too, the Australian team that went there as a whole, they got some crap from their national organization about the fact that they were, you know, no one got closer than 7 minutes to the winner, blah, blah, blah. And that's just a bunch of BS. I think the Australian riders, for the first time since they've been going to Worlds, every Australian rider finished on the lead lap, first time they've been able to accomplish that, showing progress. And I think, you know, props to them for putting in that work and making that happen. So,
and when you say, Scott, for the time since they've started going to Worlds, that's only been what, three, maybe two, but 3 years tops?
Maybe
that's
four.
That's an amazing result.
Yeah, yeah.
Given how short a time they've been going to work.
Absolutely.
They have every right to be proud of what they've done.
Here's what the Americans did. Stephen Hyde, 23rd place. Jeremy Powers, 34th. Yannick Ekman, 35th. And then actually Chris Jongeward, Australia, who we were talking about, in 36th place. Travis Liverman in 39th, Alan Krugoff in 41st, and Anthony Clark in 43rd.
All right. Cool.
Jeremy Duren, 56.
Right. So, yeah, you know, here's an example. Chris Jongeward started 7th row, finished 36. Power started 1st row, finished 34th. Not bad.
Not too shabby.
Yeah, yeah. So,
all right. So we just give you Andre Vanderpool's quote there, because we're talking about him going to the road or not going to the road. This is where Andre Vanderpool said, "Do the Belgians like to see Matthew? An entire section does not, I think. Maybe he should just follow Lars Boom and Zdenek Stybar and choose road cycling."
Yeah, because he was mad about the fans.
Too. Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. Okay, I think we should give a little bit of more of a mention to the fact that it's Sven's last Worlds.
Yes.
Yeah. Got it.
Worlds. Not his last race. His last
Worlds.
But still, he was in it. You know, it was interesting. We were talking about if Powell's was going to sit up at the end and let him get on the podium. And I credit to Kevin Powell's to not doing that. And I don't think that Sven would have liked that anyway. Those guys.
I think Sven probably would have been pissed at him.
I think he would have. And, you know, so Powell's coming in third, Sven fourth, extremely emotional at the end of that race. The world championships, he won two of them, but always, you know, the pressure was on him to win, to carry the glory for Belgium, and more times than not he had a disappointing result. So I think he was extremely happy with fourth place in his final, still at, you know, 40 years old to be racing at the top with these guys. Another one worth mentioning, that we almost had a David Vanderpool beating his brother. David Vanderpool ending up sixth, and that guy,
yes,
man, that guy needs more love. Sixth place in a world championship, and no one's going to talk about him.
And yeah, that's true. That's very true. That's very true. That we were talking about it. JB and I were talking about that during the race. That, man, that's David Vanderpool. What is going on? You know. So yes, absolutely, I agree with you there, Bill.
Some of our other favorites to follow: Lawrence Swick was seventh, Tom Mason in eighth.
And another, Swick too, another, I mean, it was like, man, he's, you know, normally he goes to the front and then dies and fades way back, but managing to stay up there and not falling behind,
and
farther back than seventh was great.
Here's another great ride, Radomir Šimonek, who we haven't heard from all year. I kept thinking it was Michael Boris up there, who's had a much better ride from the Czech Republic this year, but no, Šimonek up there, like, in the lead group for the longest time, and then ended up the race in ninth.
Yeah, so... I know we're still going to do a season wrap-up show in a couple weeks. Is that correct?
That's correct, yep.
So we will talk more then about Sven and kind of, you know, review his season as a whole, because a lot of stuff after the season he had last year, we were talking about a lot of stuff going into the season this year. So we'll talk more about that in a couple weeks when we do our season wrap-up show. And we're thinking we'll do awards too, right? Our famous awards, Bill?
Our famous one. Yes. second annual award show.
And we're either going to have to go back and look up what they were or create new ones.
So famous, we can't even remember what they were.
All right, guys. Well, this is, I mean, what do you think? So, best world is best world of my lifetime that I've ever been paying attention since I've been paying attention to cross. I don't know about you guys, but yes,
I think consistently for races, every race, definitely no disappointments in any of those races.
David,
the only thing that the only other worlds that I can compare it to, and it was only better because we were there,
yep,
was Louisville.
Right.
As quality of racing goes, this was the best in quite some time.
You know, I would say last year there were close races, but you have to factor in, and nothing against Tauber, but the course, just, you know, you can't beat the Zolder course and the kind of races we had.
I agree. Yep. I agree. So, all right, guys. Well, pleasure talking about Worlds with you, doing our Worlds wrap-up. Did we cover everything? Anybody, any last comments or anything? What an amazing season, guys.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I'm just, like, still buzzing from the whole season. So, can't wait to talk to you guys more about it as the season officially completely finishes. We'll talk about that. Still some super prestige, right? A lot of good super prestige races still.
Six more UCI races, eight more races for Sven.
So once those happen, we'll get back together. We'll do a season wrap up and wrap this whole thing up on Crosshairs Radio. They don't do that in Europe. Guys, anything else to say? Mr. David Palin, where can people get in touch with you?
I'm on Twitter at Mr. David Palin. That'd be the best place to find me. Also on Instagram at Mr. David Palin, but usually
Bill,
Twitter.
And Bill, I'm guessing if people are listening to this, they already know where to get a hold of you.
CX Hairs, also let us know how we did. Any comments, questions, anything else, feedback@cxhairs.com.
And I am Scott Dienbach at CyclocrossNet on Twitter, or CyclocrossNetwork@gmail.com if you want to shoot me an email. Guys, thanks for being with me again, and we'll do this again for another They Don't Do That in Europe on Crosshairs Radio.
And, Bill, maybe we can get on Crosshairs when we remember or figure out what we're going to do for those awards. We can have people tweet or send in their suggestions.
We can do that.
Yeah.
All right. We'll see you guys.
All right, guys.
All right. Later. And there it is. Crosshairs Radio episode 22, all wrapped up. The World Championship now in the rear view, but I'm sure we'll still be talking about this version of that event for weeks, months, if not years to come. Thanks again to Scott Diedenbach and David Palin for joining me for another episode of They Don't Do That in Europe. And I will check in with all of you for episode 23 of Crosshairs Radio next week. See you then.